Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 23. In all the years Boris had been coming to this little beach house on the coast of the Black Sea, he had never seen a night so clear and calm. The waves barely licked against the shore. The tide hadn't gone out very far for weeks, but tonight the sea was smooth as a lake. The local sandpiper raced up and down the edge of the water looking for somewhere to stick its beak, but there was no water flowing back down the slope shore to expose the tiny burrowing crabs upon which it fed. He complained with his peaceful, high-pitched staccato chirp into the moonless night for hundreds of yards up and down the water's edge to no avail. The air hung chilly just outside his nostrils. Still, along with his life for the past few months alone in the graying little house built up a few feet off the sand on stilts. The legs of his chair sunk a few inches into the sand as he sat down and shoved his hands into the pockets of his brown leather jacket. The night sky was twisting around a new star, he noticed. The once faint little star out past the cup edge of the Big Dipper circled around the middle dark rift in the Milky Way that sprayed across the night sky from horizon to horizon. The tremors had become less and less until they stopped completely a couple of days ago. The American Reporter's daily broadcast was getting more and more faint, but with the most recent message, he knew the worlds had probably come apart completely now. The sun was low in the sky throughout the day, and he knew it would not be long until the tiny mountains of ice would begin floating past the little summer house. At first, the bureaucratic accountant in him inventoried the food and guessed it would last 2 or 3 more months. He thought about moving across the country and up the isthmus into the Ukraine, but he woke up one morning and decided he would stay. Besides, the little 2-cylinder car he rented hadn't started for weeks. It didn't matter. He leaned his head back and tried to trace the star constellations out in his mind. Like slowly shimmering clouds, they washed out the lines of the Archer, the Twins, and the Crab. He fixed his eyes on Arcturus, bright and high in the heavens, and saw something move in his periphery. He flicked his eyes toward the movement, hoping to perhaps track a satellite when he remembered he hadn't seen one in over a month. The few remaining geosynchronous satellites weren't visible more than 20,000 miles out in space. It was low in the northern horizon and moving very slowly. Just behind emerged another one, and then another. 3 golden shapes began to climb across the sky, reflecting the sun's light from far over the limb of the earth. They had to be high, perhaps a few thousand miles up, to catch that much light, he thought. As they moved across the night sky, he noticed they were long and narrow. These were not satellites. They were ships, 3 of them. Judging by their speed and the distance, each one had to be miles in length. Miss Shelley said you might be coming. So the attack begins, he said to the sandpiper, still skittering ankle-deep in the glassy black water a few yards away from his chair, on the smooth gray sand of the beach. The ships began to move apart across the silent Arctic sky. He knew battle formations when he saw them. His energy bureau attended a war game where the great Soviet Navy practiced such a maneuver, letting the center carrier be detected by the enemy while the other carrier groups sailed wide over the horizons on both flanks. The destroyers would attack with low and fast missiles from those positions, while the aircraft would take off and fly a pattern over the center carrier, waiting for the entire flight to get airborne. The enemy would become fixated on the aircraft, slowly circling with their flaps down, heavy with armaments and fuel, perhaps 40 miles away, while the supersonic missiles raced invisibly a few feet off the water, over the curvature of the ocean to plunge into mock enemies' Aegis-filled defense system that fitfully tried to prevent them from striking their targets. Then the forward jets would streak downward at Mach 3, jamming radar and communications while letting their computer targeting systems lock onto any aircraft that might have managed to get airborne. Soviet battle planners claimed that with this technique they could sink the entire American Navy in less than 45 minutes. He recalled telling Sasha that he was thankful when the Soviet Empire finally collapsed under the weight of its own arrogance, for it would most assuredly have meant the end of the world. But then Boris's world was destroyed anyway, on a cold spring day at the hands of a mindless jihadi animal. And he remembered the other beasts who lured him with his rage into their plan to nuke Mecca and Medina. He shifted in his chair, trying to escape the feeling of how close he came to typing in those codes to join his Sasha in a nuclear blast. "Come now what may," he whispered to the sandpiper. He returned his drifting attention to the ships that had moved asymptotically to a position far southwest of his chair. He stood up and repositioned it so he could watch the golden light flickering off their shiny hulls. "Piss-poor camouflage, my friends," he said loudly to the sky over the beach house, as they sat there. "What are they waiting for?" He noticed a shard of light come from each of the three craft. No, they weren't lights. It looked like tiny droplets of light coming out of the bellies of these space carriers. "The attack force," he whispered, not wanting to blink. It seemed like half an hour as the tiny light ships fell out of these motherships. It seemed like hundreds of them arranging themselves in attack formations. He knew it would not be long now. Those lighter ships couldn't have the shielding to sit out there exposed to the Van Allen radiation belts. His bureaucratic mind was trying to account for fuel, oxygen, and how impossible the gravitational forces of a binary planet system would be to negotiate without experience in such battle conditions. It felt like watching a movie, but he shivered in the cold night air, thinking about Western Europe sitting directly beneath the attack force of space Stuka dive bombers prepared to lay waste to the innocent people below. "You bastards!" he yelled into the night. He buried his burning eyes into his hands and tried to cry, but there were no more tears. His heart was trained to be cold, and it had already been broken too many times for one lifetime. He was never a man of faith, but rather took pride in his superior ability to accumulate knowledge. He tried to pray for the defenseless people about to be attacked, but he knew there was no one listening. He tried that before, but it did not spare his precious Sasha or his cat. For the better part of 3 centuries, his people had been at war with the Europeans. Time after time, the West invaded his country, only to have their frozen bodies crushed into the plains outside Leningrad. His ancestors fought them, until weapons had become so terrible that no sane person would pull such a sword from its scabbard. All the spying and subterfuge and underhanded political deals that his government had perpetrated against the West, and now, at the end, he wanted mercy for them. At least, he thought at last, death would come quickly for them. He pulled his bearded face from his palms and swept his long hair back under his fur collar and pulled the fur up tied against his neck. He looked back at the armada, sitting like golden terror in the stars, and waited for their next move. Perhaps it was their plan to sit there for a while, like the ancient Mongolian hordes sitting at sunrise with the sun at their backs far out of range, beating their swords against their shields and blowing their battle horns and beating enormous drums at the enemy before they charged. His heart began to sink as he watched the first wave break slowly away from the formation. They accelerated at unbelievable speed, forming ranks and approaching their targets on the surface. There was no sound as about a third of the strike force descended. They formed a line of ships too wide and began moving toward the first target. Boris stood up to get a better view of the horizon, but it really didn't add much. The flat Crimean landscape extended for miles from the beach. He stuck his hands back into his pockets and paced along the beach, watching the progress of the attack. He expected to see a relentless bombardment of the surface by these fast attack ships. As soon as it began, the entire line of ships broke into disarray. The ships at the front of the line exploded into an enormous flash, and a slowly expanding green cloud began to form. The rest of the entire wave tried their best to avoid the blast, but every single craft began to explode in the same manner. The chain reaction occurred at what he figured was about 600 to 1,000 miles from the surface. The rest of the armada began to retreat. The large ships began to turn and back away from the expanding explosion. Maybe they collided in mid-space from flying too close to one another. Maybe they had a weapons malfunction. Maybe there was a missile that came from the surface. No, there was none of that. He was sure of it. He pumped his fist into the air and yelled at the top of his lungs, "Take that, you sons of bitches!" He plunged his fist into his other palm a few times and kicked at the sand. "Was that you? Did you hear me?" he asked with his fogging breath. "I didn't think so. Mr. Riker, you are one smart man. I don't know how you did it, but it looked great from here," he said to the sandpiper, who had stopped to watch him dance in the sand. He watched as the smaller ships began to merge with the mother ships. Within half an hour they were all back inside, and the shards of light went dark. The shimmering ships began to move further west, away from his field of view. "This isn't over yet, is it?" he whispered. The green cloud was dissipating, but it was still visible. Streaks of debris disintegrated into white twinkles as the pieces of the ships began to fall to earth. "Looks like a third of the host of heaven fell to their doom this day," said Boris, as he picked up his chair and carried it back to the porch of the little gray house. He knew the ships eventually would figure out how to approach the planet without hitting a minefield like that he just witnessed. He also knew he could not heat this little house with the oil in the tank outside and the tiny bit of wood he had gathered over the past few months. He couldn't help thinking about it. He could drain the remaining diesel fuel out of the little two-cylinder car he had used to reach this summer house. There was about 6 gallons there. He wondered about this new earth. He boiled some water for tea and put his hands over the steam to warm them up again. What were they going to do without a sun? "You need some bureaucrats, I think," he said to the billowing steam from the kettle. "How will we make tea without energy, Mr. President?" he asked as he poured the hot water into the mug containing the tea bag. He pressed on the bag with a spoon to keep it under the water and walked over to the window. He looked out and up under the eave of the little house for some kind of activity, but there wasn't any. He turned on the little radio and scanned through the dial for any type of signal, but there was nothing. He turned it back off. He trimmed the kerosene lamp to conserve energy and walked back to the little counter and picked up the mug. He sat down in the large wooden rocking chair and stirred the spoon a little in the cup to speed up the brewing and sniffed at it to see if it was strong enough to overcome the earthy taste of the well water. He reached over for the blue and red afghan that Sasha had made for this place years ago when they came here on their honeymoon and dragged it across his lap. They had seen the most opulent halls in the world and dined with the finest wines and met the most important people. But when they got married, they came to this little three-room cottage on the clean shores of the Black Sea. He only wanted to look at her. He took a sip of the tea, deciding it was almost there, and leaned back in the rocker. The planks in the floor creaked rhythmically as the rails rolled back and forth across the uneven surface. He wrapped the tea bag string around the spoon and across the bag to squeeze the water out of it and laid it on the coaster on the nightstand. The black tea felt good going down his dry throat, and the heat calmed the complaining cold that soaked the rest of his body. He thought about how long it would take for this earth to travel across the Milky Way, like the American reporter was telling the world. 4.5 billion years old is this planet. Maybe, 6,000 years since Noah's day? All that way with no sun. What difference does it make? He asked the room. Still, the tea was delicious, and the sun would come up tomorrow. Tomorrow is another day, he said across the mug, as he realized he had emptied it. Perhaps it was the silence that took so long, or the soothing herbs in the tea. He felt the wave go through his body like the aroma of something in the back of his memory. He placed the empty mug carefully on the nightstand and slid his hands under the warming afghan across his lap. He leaned his head against the high back of the rocker and looked over at the small yellow flame frozen in the globe of his lantern. The slow creaking of the floor sounded like a door opening, and then he saw a light.